Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, today is known as National DNA Day. It's a day that Congress deemed should be set aside to commemorate the completion of the Human Genome Project. So we thought we'd invite a leader of the project into our studios to talk about some of the latest in genetics and in science. Eric Lander is president and founding director of the Broad Institute at MIT and Harvard. He's also co-chair of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Welcome.
Hey, welcome, Deb.
So let's start about the Human Genome Project on this National DNA Day, which I never knew was a holiday until today. So the project was first completed 13 years ago. Where are we, broadly but concisely, where are we now? And is it taking longer than you thought to use some of the research from the project in more everyday applications?
Actually, the first thing I should say is that National DNA Day really commemorates the anniversary of the publication of the Watson and Crick paper about the double helical structure of DNA. It was published on this day in 1953. Mm-hmm. So as it happens, it also is the anniversary of the completion of the Human Genome Project.
It was just a coincidence.
Well, not quite a coincidence. Yeah. It was the case that the Human Genome Project was launched about 1990, progressed for about 13 years, and as we were getting close, 3 years before we were sort of done, everybody said, how cool would it be to finish on the day, on the half-century anniversary of the Watson-Crick paper? So everybody stayed up really late and worked their tails off, and labs around the world in six different countries to get a Human Genome Project completed. So Watson and Crick really get the credit for the day, and the Human Genome Project drafts in their wake. But it's still a fun day for molecular biologists and scientists and geneticists, and frankly, anybody who really cares about the future of medicine.
Yeah. So that was 13 years ago. So
that's
where
right.
Do we see sort of tangible things from the Human Genome Project right now that you think, well, this is what it means that we completed it?
Well, it is remarkable. When I think back to where we were 13 years ago, I could have never imagined how fast things have gone. So that first human genome, which was a worldwide effort, cost about $3 billion. $3 billion. And if you think, all right, suppose now we wanted to do a study of 4,000 people with diabetes and 4,000 people without diabetes and compare their genome. You know, that's, 8,000 people times $3 billion. That'd be about equal to the U.S. GDP. It would be really tough to justify spending the U.S. GDP on that one experiment.
Right.
But what's happened in those 13 years is the cost of sequencing a human genome, once we had that first one as a scaffold and with all sorts of improvements in science, has dropped by 2 million-fold. It's as if,
Does it cost now?
$1,500, and it's still dropping. Imagine if today you could buy a house 2 million times cheaper than 13 years ago. Mm. We've never seen anything drop like that. It's so much faster even than the increases in computing. And what it's meant for science, for medicine, is that it's been possible now to start looking at, let's take cancer, to look at tens of thousands of cancers from patients and ask, what are the genes that are driving those cancers? Back in the 1980s, people were very excited to have discovered a handful of such genes. We now know hundreds of different genes that play roles in skin cancers and breast cancers and brain cancers. And scientists are reorganizing cancers not by where in the body they are, but what mechanism is wrong in the cell. Let's take skin cancer, for example. Turns out, when people started looking into the DNA of skin cancers, they found that half of all patients had mutations in one particular gene. It goes by the funny name BRAF. Well, it turns out that once people knew that, they were able to develop an inhibitor for that BRAF protein. And quite miraculously, what happens is if a patient has that mutation and takes that drug, their cancer typically disappears, but only for about 9 months.
Huh.
Then it'll come back. And then scientists now are looking at those cancers and saying, okay, what changed genetically? And it turns out there are some distinctive changes, and there are now some drugs that work against those changes. And what there is now is an ongoing cat and mouse game with cancer that's a bit like what it was with HIV not so long ago. Eventually, you know, at the beginning, every drug you used against HIV, there'd be resistance a year or two later. But eventually, a triple drug therapy brought it under control. Well, that's what the hope is with cancer, that by understanding, using the genome, what's wrong in different cancers and how they respond when you treat with a drug and you know, how they'll develop a resistance, that there'll be a recipe for each of those. So there's now more than 700 different drugs for cancer under development, and the vast majority of them are targeted at particular DNA targets.
So we've moved a lot closer to personalized or maybe precision medicine.
Yeah, I much prefer the term precision medicine, because personalized suggests that there's going to be a drug for me and a drug for you, and I can't see how we're going to develop truly personal drugs. But what's the precision about? It's about understanding what's wrong under the hood. It'd be like, you know, precision car mechanics. If you tried to bring your car in and people couldn't pop the hood to see what was wrong, you'd have pretty imprecise car mechanics. Mm. So, you know, we're trying, and there's been great progress in diseases like schizophrenia, for example.
That was an interesting development just back in January.
Well, just back in January is a great example. And this is a perfect example how, like with the Human Genome Project, it really takes collaboration to get things done these days. So for about 100 years, nobody's had any idea what really causes schizophrenia. It's been a total black box. You can't study it in a mouse. You can't tell if a mouse has schizophrenia. And you can't study it in a Petri plate. And, you know, you don't want to take brain samples out of a patient. So there really has been very little to do until genetics. So an international collaboration came along and managed first to collect about 6,000 patient samples and then 20,000, 50,000, and finally 110,000 patient samples. And by looking across genetic changes, they've been able to find 108 genes that play causal roles in schizophrenia. And one of the most amazing ones, I think the strongest signal in the entire genome, was really worked out this past January when they found out that there's a gene that drives the pruning of connections between nerve cells in the brain. Mm-hmm. And overactive forms of that pruning increase the risk of schizophrenia. So for the first time, you get to peer into the black box and say, aha, it's a disease that involves pruning. Maybe we could make drugs that might modulate that pruning. So how are we doing on this Human Genome Project? Well, I think it would have been naive to say right after we finished sequencing the human genome that we'd immediately see cures. But what we're really seeing is the basis of disease getting systematically laid out, some real therapies, in some cases cures, but it's going from black box to understood mechanisms. And I think over the course of the next couple of decades, we'll see much more of that and much more therapies. And it's just faster than I certainly expected.
Really? Faster?
Oh, much faster. I think, you know, there's a certain meme that, well, everybody expected once the Human Genome Project was done and we could see all the letters laid out on the table, poof, there would be cures. I think there's some magical thinking there that you didn't have to actually first try to understand what did the genome mean, where were the genes, and what was the mechanisms of disease, and then you'd have to work out drugs. I think this is the sort of thing that happens, you know, over the timeline of multiple decades. Like, take infectious disease. When people figured out that many diseases were caused by microbes, it was many decades later till we really had great antibiotics. But once we had them, that changed the world. And we're seeing that begin to happen for so many diseases that knowledge eventually conquers. It just doesn't do it, you know, in a year, and it doesn't do it in just a few years. But when it does it, it does it pretty permanently.
Let's talk about CRISPR. That's the technology that edits genes. It's been referred to as possibly the most important genetic engineering development in decades.
It's an amazing thing. So bacteria invented about a billion years ago this incredible immune system. If what does a bacteria have to worry about? Why does it need an immune system? Well, it turns out that bacteria get infected also. They get infected by viruses that come into their cells and very often will kill the bacteria. But it turns out that the bacteria worked out a mechanism, as I say, about a billion years ago, to remember past viruses that had infected their compatriots. And they do that by grabbing a little piece of the DNA from the virus and stuffing it into their own genome. And that becomes a little library of reminders. And they're constantly copying those reminders onto, the molecular equivalent of little yellow sticky notes. And whenever any piece of DNA is found in the cell, it compares it to the sticky note. It actually matches it up as DNA and RNA and says, oh, if this matched something on my sticky note of bad things, I'm going to cut it. So this was discovered in the course of the last 20 years or so and really characterized well in the course of the last 5 or 10 years. And then just a few years ago, groups in Berkeley and in Boston worked out a lot of the biochemistry of how this works and eventually have turned it into a tool that can be used not in bacteria but even in human cells as a way to, in a targeted fashion, cut a particular piece of DNA, alter a gene.
Tell me why that would be valuable.
Well, why could that be valuable? Imagine that somebody inherited a form of blindness, a dominantly inherited form of blindness caused by a misspelling of a gene. You might be able to take this gene editing technology, introduce it into the eye with some delivery technology, a nanoparticle or a human virus, and have it go into cells and cut that bad gene that causes a blindness. You might be able to do that in the liver with regard to important diseases around cholesterol. So you might be able to tweak your own DNA. Now, that's a really important medical possibility. It
so
could complement drugs.
Hugely controversial. Right?
Well, the most controversial part is actually the idea not of doing it to your own retinal cells in your eye or your own liver. It's doing it to a baby. It's doing it to newborn, doing it to what we call germ cells, sperm and eggs and fertilized embryos that would make not just changes in a person's body, but permanent changes in the human gene pool. I think the real controversy comes around, should we start just 13 years after actually reading the human genome for the first time, should we start going around saying, oh, I can improve that genome and let's make permanent changes to our species? A lot of us, myself included, are kind of dubious that that's yet an appropriate thing to do, if ever. And it's certainly not a decision up to scientists. That'd be something that society at large would really have to decide in a concerted way that it's supported. Hmm.
But there's also a controversy over this technology itself. It's undergoing a patent fight right now. You mentioned the researchers at Berkeley and the researchers at Broad and who got there first, and then a letter that you wrote in Cell regarding the history of CRISPR.
Yes.
Some folks said that you should not be writing the history if you have a dog in the fight. And so I want you to respond to both
sure,
of those
sure,
things.
Sure. So the history of CRISPR is fantastic. It's really, really interesting. And I think a lot of the focus has just been on the last couple of years. So I ended up writing a lengthy article trying to unearth the rest of the history of CRISPR, to open up the lens and really credit the dozen or more people going back to the great scientist in Spain, this 28-year-old graduate student who actually discovered CRISPR, a group in France, of all places, the Ministry of Defense, who also discovered how CRISPR works, a yogurt company, a scientist there, Philippe Horvath, who worked out how this system works, scientists in Chicago and Lithuania. So I ended up writing a real history to try to open up the lens and include everybody. And, of course, when you do that, then it, of course, I think provoked some reaction from the later people in the story who are saying, wait a second, in sharing credit so broadly, what about the credit to the later people? It's really hard to get all those balances right. It really is. Usually reviews are written by people who are deeply familiar about the field. And in this case, I thought it was really important to send the message that no scientific discovery is the work of any one or two or three scientists. It's usually the work of an entire community coming together over the course of decades. I think it's the right perspective, but I fully appreciate people have other perspectives, and the closer folks are to this, to you know, one or another aspect of it, you know, you'll have very different perspectives. And I think it's important to have many of those.
Well, maybe it's difficult to give everyone credit, but what about the argument that the fact that there's this fight going on over it at the same time and, you know, should that have been differently disclosed in terms of you writing the history?
Oh, well, I think there's an issue about the fact that there are many patents filed about that. And it's certainly the case that there's probably more than 100 different patent applications. It's the case that, you know, histories you write today have very little effect on patent fights. Patent fights all have to do with what's in the lab notebooks going back 3 or 4 years ago. I think a lot of it much more is about credit. But certainly the idea of people being aware that there are those patent fights are important. I've certainly disclosed that before. Would have been good to put a sentence in the article about it then. But there's no secret about those things. I think, in fact, the real issue is how do we recognize credit in science? And do we have good ways to recognize credit in science? You know, we have things like Nobel Prizes with some podium with space for three people. But increasingly, it's not a good match to what goes on. And I think as a community for the 21st century, we need to think about how do we really give credit in science to a much larger number of people? Because everything from the Human Genome Project to CRISPR to developments in schizophrenia and cancer, it takes a village to do science. It's usually an ensemble act, not the story of some one lone genius working alone at the bench.
All right, and we'll see where we'll be 13 years from now. All right, Eric Lander, president and founding director of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, thank you so much for coming in.
Great to be here. Happy DNA Day, Deb.
Happy DNA Day. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.